So thank you very much to the organizers. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm going to speak about acute triangulations of polyotope. So let me go straight to the problem. So the problem is the following. We're given a simplex is called acute if all the dihedral angles are strictly smaller than pi over 2. Very important. Most important definition here, okay? Strictly smaller than pi over 2. And so in particular, you know, if you have a triangle is acute if it's acute. So an acute triangulation is a subdivision into finite number of acute simplices. So if you have a polygon in the plane, I'm going to be looking at acute triangulation, which is a subdivision into acute triangles. So just to give you an illustration, this is an actual acute triangulation, and this is not. Do you see why not? Because it has points in the middle of the edges, not a subdivision. Don't want that. Want this. Okay? Somebody say yes. Clear? Yes. Very good. So the question is quite basic. Given a convex polytope, find an acute triangulation, or somewhat different question. You want to find an acute partition of the space, which is a partition into acute an acute simplices. And the problem doesn't sound all too difficult, but it turns out to be really old and quite famous. And before I tell you lots of different things about the problem, let me just give you, I decided to call it as a main color. So here is the result we just obtained. We can show that a d-dimensional cube has an acute triangulation only in the dimension 2 and 3. In high dimension, it cannot have an acute triangulation. Okay? So an acute triangulation of the square you saw here, and the acute triangulation of E cube you'll see later, and there's nothing else. So this is somewhat surprising, and this problem was actually asked many times before, and somehow, and if you look at the literature, people actually asked it in different directions. Some people thought there exists such acute triangulation, some people thought they don't. But until now, none of this was known pretty much. So where is the problem coming from? As it turns out, there are actually many reasons to study this problem. The dihedral angle is very easy to measure. You take two facets, and you measure the angle between them, in interior angle. Is that your question? It's strictly smaller than pi over 2. Yeah. So for example, if you maybe I should go back and say that if you do allow right dihedral angles, then cube in any dimension can be subdivided into non-acute tetrahedra. Simply, there is a sort of like easy triangulation to de factorial non-acute simplices. So it's actually very important that they're acute rather than non-acute. That's what makes the problem very difficult. So this turns out to be, I didn't know that actually when I started working on that. This turned out to be a very classical geometric problem. Actually, maybe if I did, I shouldn't have worked on that. So the most popular application into something called finite element method, and the idea is the following. Suppose you're given some polygon or some general surface. Let's say you have a body of this crocodile, and you want to solve some PDE over the body of the crocodile. So the question is, how do you do that numerically? And you know, the way people typically do that is they make triangulation of the body of the crocodile, and then use the solve PDE, you know, looking at functions over every point. And somehow the idea is that this this PDE is don't converge if the angles are large enough. So you want small enough angles so that everything works fine. And if you talk to various people in the field, and ask them what exactly do you need from a triangulation, they're gonna, all of them are gonna tell you different answers. So so from some very extreme to some very vague, but basically they want tetrahedra and more general simplices to be as close to regular as possible. Now you cannot have them exactly regular, but you know, they want something close to be regular, and so the acuteness condition is actually a good enough approximation. So so all these nice pictures are not mine, and are done by people who are in the finite element community. And the idea is that so in this case you have a face, and you look at this tetrahedral mesh, as they call it. And if you look closely, you're going to see that around some edges there are very few tetrahedra, let's say four. That immediately means that there are some angles must be large. It cannot be acute acute triangulation. You can sort of, if you look closely, you'll see those points and those edges around which you have four or even three sometimes. So again, given a triangulated surface, you want to find a good acute triangulation, and no one knows how to do that in practice, and people desperately want to. So this is this another picture by a group in Berlin, which I stole from their website. And the way it works is it's sort of typical. They input about 21,000 points, and you know, the program works and gets about 1.4 million tetrahedra. And again, if you look very closely, you'll and they actually give the data, the angles sometimes are really, really large, what they get in practice. That's not what they want, but that's what they can do. Okay? So that's where the problem is coming from. Clear? Okay. So let me start. So I'm going to sort of go up the dimensions slowly, and then so I'm going to start with a plane, and then I'm going to go to three dimensions higher. So in the plane, the problem turned out to be about 50 years old, and it was posed by Martin Gardner, Scientific American, and there's been a flurry of just, you know, very large number of some recreational results which I've never actually read, but they're all about the plane. What happens in the plane, what's the best angle that you can get, and so forth. And it's actually, even for the square, it's not completely clear if they figured out smallest possible largest angle in a triangulation that you can get for a square. It's a kind of funny little recreational problem that they're doing. The message that I wanted to give is that it's in practice it's actually very easy to do, and theoretically it's easy. So this theorem that's a fairly recent actually summarizes the together two results give you best theoretical results, which is saying that every angle has a triangulation to very few triangles. In practice, it's very important how many triangles do you get, and many tetrahedra in three dimensions, so forth. And this acute triangulation can be calculated in linear time. It's actually nearly linear time. It's all very good. Somehow the point is that people who actually do this in practice have a fairly good idea how to do that differently. Let me skip Burago Zalgalier's paper and tell you what people really do. And the idea is quite basic. If you can start with, you know, just put lots of points inside and of a polygon, triangulate the polygon, and then let's try to improve your triangulation. This is a very basic idea of starting with one triangulation, slowly improving it. So what one can do is one can look at this quadrilateral and add up these angles. If the sum is greater than pi, then flip this diagonal to make it this way. Okay. So when you do that, that always maximizes the minimal angle of the triangulation. So it's not exactly we want to minimize the maximum angle, and it maximizes the minimal angle, but it's close enough, and it's actually for many practical applications it works. So the point is somehow eventually in the plane it's actually true that you can start with any triangulation and you continue doing the flips, and eventually you get an important triangulation called the Delaunay triangulation, which has relatively nice angles. So in this case you can see it's not true that it's always going to have only acute triangles. But that means that you put points, and you just have to put more points inside and start all over, and somehow eventually it works. Is the idea clear? That's not what practical people usually do, but the idea of improving triangulation is a very popular idea. So, and I actually done nothing in two dimensions. So I'm going to talk about what happened in high dimensions. So this is what really happens. In dimension two, the whole problem is easy. Practically easy, theoretically easy, it's relatively easy. So in dimension three, it's possible sometimes. So until basically this summer, there were no non-trivial acute triangulations known. It's sort of surprising. The problem is quite basic. You have a cube in three dimensions. Find an acute triangulation. It's been open for 30 years, give or take. No one knows exactly who was the first person who failed. but that somehow turned out to be, so we made it. So in dimension larger than 5, we have a fairly easy argument. Just a little bit, my man would say, abyssal topology, showing that this is completely impossible. There are no non-trivial acute triangulation in high dimension. In dimension 4, something is possible and something is not. Like I said in the beginning, 4-dimensional cube is impossible. There are no acute triangulations of a 4-dimensional cube. Okay. So before I tell you all this stuff, let me start with what do people do in practice? And practice, if you go and ask people, so what do you do? How do you start with working? You know, they actually have to solve these elliptic PDEs or whatever. And what they say is that they consider BCC letters. They look at this basically. They look at this kind of tetrahedra. This is one of those of the Somerville tetrahedra. And do you see how it works? So I don't have to explain it. Yeah, you take cubes and the centers of the cube. You have a cubic lattice. Take two vertices and the centers of the adjacent cubes. And it might look acute, but it's not. Do you see why it's not an acute tetrahedron? No. So for example, this dihedral angle it's almost acute. That's what they like to say. It's almost symmetric, but it's not. It's not. The good news is that it does tile the whole space. So what they do is they start with that, and then, you know, when they get close to the boundary, they make some weird decision and then keep improving your triangulation sort of along the same way, along the same rules that I explained before. This is what they actually do. And of course that's not working for us at all. These are not acute. We need to do something else. But it's a start. So one thing that you can look at before we figure out what to do with the cube, can we tile the whole space with a cube tetrahedron in R3? That seemed like an easy question to ask. And apparently Aristotle asked it first. So he claimed that regular tetrahedron tiles the whole space. It's not true, of course. And that's it. And it took until basically the Middle Ages to figure out that this is false. People believed him. He was an honorable man. So after years of wanderness, Somerville found four space-filling tetrahedra in 23, and that was actually not the end. There are two other space-filling families found by Goldberg. They had a slightly different definition of space-filling. Goldberg allowed reflections and Somerville didn't. But that's basically it. There are only a few families known which tile space periodically, and neither of these families, neither of these tetrahedra are acute. So it's actually, it remains an open problem whether you can take one tetrahedron and tile the whole space with the corpus of that tetrahedron. It's sort of embarrassing. So an important advancement was made in this paper by Epstein, Sullivan, and Ungar. They found a periodic acute partition of R3, so they don't use one tetrahedra, they use several types of tetrahedra, which together allow you to fill the whole space with the corpus of this. I think that they use four, I could be wrong. The question whether you can use one is still open, and it's a little unclear which way it's going to go. So here is a theorem. I'm going to show that you can have an acute triangulation of a cube, and this theorem is independently obtained by this group of people and that group of people at about the same time this past summer. So after 30 years. These are completely different triangulations, and these are sort of practical people, and these are more theoretical people, if I can distinguish. There is no formal distinction. So what they do is they use a lot of computer simulations and keep on doing this mesh improving technique. So they actually found this numerically after lots of tries and errors, and some very interesting symmetry ideas. What we did, we started with from a completely different point. We started with a regular polytope in four dimensions, the one that has 600 tetrahedral faces. And what we did is that we took that polytope and somehow cut it and embedded what remains in R3. So as much as I can, explain what's going on. So let's see. So how fluent are you with a 600 cell? Not at all, right? Okay, so that picture is supposed to illustrate the 600 cell, and it's kind of like a view from the vertex. So when you look out of the vertex, you see. You see an icosahedron, and then when you look through, you see lots of other points, and they somehow look further and further away. This is a picture from Wikipedia. And so what we do is basically the following: we look at one tetrahedral face. Since I cannot draw in four dimensions, this will do. And I color it red. Then you remove that face, that facet, and all adjacent facets to that tetrahedron. Okay? That's the first step. So have a gigantic polytope. Very nice, very regular. You remove lots of tetrahedra to make it like a sphere with a hole. So what remains is 543 three-dimensional surface. Okay? The next step is a stereographic projection. So what this original 600 cells were regular, transcribed into a sphere in four dimension. So what you do when you do a stereographic projection, you project what's left from the surface into R3. So you get something. It's not going to be nice. It's not going to be convex, but somehow the angles are going to be kind of good. Here is why. The idea is that that in this 600 cell around you can sort of see it maybe on a previous picture, but it's kind of hard to imagine. There are exactly five tetrahedral faces around every edge. That can be taken as a definition actually of a 600 cell. There are exactly five regular tetrahedral around edge, which means that it has a chance that to eventually give us the desired triangulation, because it had only four, for example, three, we're doomed. Then around some of the dihedral angles will be large. See what I mean? You do need five. And that turned out to work. So turn out after you do that, you push things around a little bit, not too much actually, to embed it into and to regular tetrahedron. And maybe I should show you a picture. We'll see. So, let's see. This is what the result looks like. That's an acute triangulation of a regular tetrahedron. It's quite tricky actually. So there are about 96, about 100 points inside. Okay, so they sort of cluster very much in the middle, and you can see this is a triangle. And let's see, where is my talk? And along each triangular face, you get this nice kind of acute triangulation of each face. Okay, that's what's going on. Is it at least a little bit clear? Something, yeah. So, and you do the same, you sort of push points in a slightly different way to embed it in the middle of the corner tetrahedron, and you put things together, and eventually you get an acute triangulation of a cube. It has about 2700 tetrahedra inside. And it's the first one that was constructed. Okay? So we did it. So our competitors, they did it with fewer tetrahedra at about the same time, but in a completely different way. So anyway, this is what the eventual. Now the computational part is pretty much over. This is what we did, and to calculate exactly, you take 543, multiply by 5, and that's going to be the number of tetrahedra that are in that cube. All right. So we actually checked, and our approach turned out to be robust. So we can obtain non-trivial acute triangulation not only of a tetrahedron in a cube, but actually also octahedron, dodecahedron, so we can do all platonic solids, and I think we can also do pretty much all simplices, but it's incomplete right now. So what I want to do is I want to say that I actually believe that every convex polytop in R3 has an acute triangulation. That's what I honestly believe. So it's a little far-reaching, because until now cube was not known. But I think it's going to be true eventually, and we'll see how that's going to go. Oh, let's see. Everyone with me? Can I move on to higher dimensions? So the computational part is going to be over. Okay. So dimension 5. So, like I said, you shouldn't hope for much. and so here is the theorem that we proved. Every a point in R5 cannot be even surrounded with acute simplices. So you can have an acute triangulation by, you know, putting two acute simplices together, but you cannot make anything non-trivial. So that is to have a point in the interior of of a polyhedron. That just doesn't work. And the proof is somehow has nothing to do with geometry, pretty much. It's a basic topological result. What we do is we call d-manifold rich if every codimensional two-phase is surrounded with at least five simplices. So we have a simplicial manifold, and we say it's rich if it's a three manifold, every edge has at least five tetrahedra around. Remember, this is very similar to what we had in a 600 cell. Okay, there were exactly five tetrahedra around every edge, and then we used Dan Samuel's equation, and turns out that if you use them in the right order, then the number of points in such a manifold, if every rich four-dimensional manifold, then the number of points is bounded from above by the Eulerian characteristic. I'll show you in 2 minutes how that goes. It's actually very easy to prove. This is the only actual proof that I'll give you. Let me show you how this result implies the theorem. Here is the whole proof. If there was this non-trivial triangulation, if there was this point surrounded by simplices, just look at the intersection with a sphere. Yeah? I'm thinking of five dimension. You intersect with a sphere. That's a fourth sphere. That gives you a rich simplicial four manifold M. And now according to this calculation, it's gonna have to have very few points, very few vertices, simply because the Eulerian characteristic of a sphere is very, very small. If you've ever had to calculate this kind of thing. So this immediately implies that you cannot have anything like that. Okay? So now let me show you the whole proof. I'll do it very quickly, so in case you're already bored, you're not going to be suffered too much. So let's see. So this is basically a corollary of Poincaré duality. F numbers are the numbers for number of phases of each dimension, and if you look at the closed manifold, you write it down, and you come up with these two equations. Okay, so you're gonna have to trust me on this, and so just look and see how that's the whole proof of this. Really old question, really old problem, and not to have, half a page proof. So here is the idea. So remember, I'm proving the lambda, the number of vertices is bounded from above by the Eulerian characteristic, and what you do is you look at delta 2 inside delta 4 flag, so that this is a two-dimensional phase inside four-dimensional phases. You pretty quickly figure out that the number of these flags, it has to be 10 times the number of four-dimensional faces, simply because each four-dimensional simplex has 10 two-dimensional faces. That's on one hand. On the other hand, M is bounded from below by 5 times the number of two-dimensional faces, and the way you do it is you remember that this has to be a rich manifold. So around every two-dimensional phase, there has to be at least 5 four-dimensional simplices. That's the only place where we're using richness condition. So we get this inequality. F2 is at most 2F4. And then you write down 2 times number Eulerian characteristic minus the number of vertices. You write down, you use this relation that I wrote before. and you get that result. You're done. There's really nothing to the proof. It's just one line of calculation, plus very standard and final notation. Okay? I'm not hoping that you actually follow the whole line, but you can see the complexity of the problem. The problem turned out to be much, much easier than we expected. So that in dimension 5, there is really, and higher, there is really no hope. So what happens in dimension 4? And the first result that we immediately realize that there is no periodic acute partition of R4. Here is why. If you had a periodic acute partition of R4, that gives you, because it's periodic, that gives you a reach for dimensional torus, right? And again, Eulerian characteristic of a torus is very, very small. So from the previous lemma that I had before, there is no periodic acute partition of R4. And on the other hand, if you have an acute triangulation of a 4-cube, then you can keep reflecting it to fill the whole space. That gives you periodic acute partition of R4. That's it. We're done. Four-dimensional cube does not have an acute triangulation. That's all there is. It's a really basic result. There is nothing there. So since it's basic, I have to tell you the real theorem. And this is the real theorem. This is what we're very proud to show. And that's our main result. So not only there is no acute partition, periodic acute partition of R4, but in fact there is no partition of R4 into simplices where dihedral angles are bounded from bounded away by epsilon from the from pi over 2. Okay? So to see that this is stronger, you simply realize that if there was a periodic, then they give you some epsilon. Right? So this is a much stronger result, and if you start thinking about it, it's not even clear how to approach this result. And let's see. But I'll tell you more about that in a minute. So this is what I just this is just a repetition of what I had before. If you have a 4-cube, you can reflect it to get a partition of R4, and if you have acute partition of R4, it gives you a rich triangulation of a 4-torus, which proves the result. So before I give you the proof, or at least the sketch of the proof, let me mention that this case, the four-dimensional case, is actually the most interesting as far as I'm concerned. So remember, we conjecture that in R3, despite the apparent difficulty, everything is possible. I don't think there is any, let's say, convex polytop which has no acute triangulation. On the other hand, in R4, the cube does not have an acute triangulation. On the other hand, there are some non-trivial acute triangulation. For example, this 600 cell I began with has an acute triangulation. You simply start at the center and take cones over all the facets. That gives you an acute triangulation. So there's got to be some way to figure out which polytops do have an acute triangulations and which don't. And at the moment, I know very little about that. So unfortunately, even so let me mention one very nice case of a cross polytop. I believe that cross polytop does not have an acute triangulation. And I have a little bit of a reason behind, so I'm willing to bet that the answer is no. So the reason is, I actually say it here, the reason is that what I know is that the space can be tiled with a regular cross polytop. This is a very special property of R4. R4 can be tiled with regular cross polytop, but this is not a tiling using reflection. You see, around every, let me think, two-dimensional phase, there are exactly three cross polytops. I know it's hard to visualize. But if you think about it, that implies that you cannot just keep reflecting and obtain a timing of R4 with cross polytop. So all I can prove is that there is no kind of totally symmetric on the at least on the boundary acute triangulation of a cross polytop. But I wouldn't know what happens with general triangulation. There might be, I just don't think so. And another conjecture is that I believe that R4 actually has an acute partition. This is a pure speculation, and this is my personal speculation. I think it's true, and I'm working on it. But this for people actually believe the opposite. They believe that so they conjecture that it's impossible to do, and they have good arguments. It's just that all these arguments are totally speculative. So since I'm giving a talk, you might as well listen to my arguments rather than their arguments. I guess I can be fair. Their argument is basically that if there was such a triangulation, then around every point you would have to have at least like 600 tetrahedra, which is a lot. So it's actually even hard to visualize how would one go about with 600 tetrahedra every time and fill the whole R4. So they can't visualize, but I think I can. I just don't know how to do that. So my argument is that remember we proved the sort of halfway. We showed there's no partition where the dihedral angles are bounded away from pi over 2. So I'm saying that's actually a clue. There probably is a partition into acute simplices which sort of get taller and taller every time. So the dihedral angles will sort of tend to pi over 2 when you go to infinity. It's a speculation. Is that clear? What I was just speculating about? Question about that? No? Answers? No? Okay, so back to the theorem. So I have about, how much time do I have?
12 minutes.
Oh, excellent. Maybe before I show you the proof, I'll motivate where the proof comes from. Can you see if I start drawing here? No? Ilya, it's your job. Okay, thanks. So the idea goes back to really old result by Alexandrov, which is I think it's about 1930s. Let me write it this way. So what he proved is that if you have let's look at the at a triangulation of the plane. And so the question is, suppose I tell you that all angles are bounded. So all the angles don't tend to 0 pi over 2, all angles are bounded from both above and below. Can you have a triangulation with let's say degree always greater or equal to 7. Is that possible? What do you think? Of the plane, of the whole plane with this condition? Say no. If you don't believe it, just say no, right? Correct. You would be correct. And the proof is actually not difficult. But it's a theorem. But it's a kind of theorem that I've actually never seen in print anywhere before I actually read that paper, which probably has never been translated into English. So if you start thinking about it, how would you prove this kind of result? So you so the idea of the proof would be that actually the average degree will have to tend to 6, right? So what does it mean, average degree? Well, you know, you take bigger and bigger disk and you look what's inside, right? And then at some point you sort of quickly see that you have to apply the parametric inequality. So that's, so now with this data, you can sort of go home and reconstruct the whole proof. It's just like one page. It's not a big deal.
You don't have to worry about the triangle getting small.
That's what I said in the beginning. Everything is angles, that's angles bounded from above. All angles are governed from above and below. That implies that the ratio on the edge length in each triangle. That's all you have to worry about. And so think of that as kind of a nice exercise, but it has a message. It's a similar type result. That's what I wanted to say. So what I'm going to be proving is that if you have a rich triangulation, so forget again about geometry. If you have a rich partition of the whole space R4, then something goes wrong. Then some tetrahedral angles will go to pi over 2. That's what I'm going to be proving. So if the bound is away from pi over 2, then you couldn't partition the space. And the hint is that, again, you have to look at bigger and bigger balls of radius R in R4, and you have to apply some kind of isoperimetric inequality. It's going to be a very different type of isoperimetric inequality, very different from anything I've seen before, but not very different from what other people have seen before. So we basically use somebody's work on this isoperimetric inequality to prove that result. Is the scheme clear? Okay, so here is the outline of the proof. So first I make the same kind of observation as I made before, that bounded geometry basically means that the ratio of edge length in every tetrahedron is bounded. Then I use boundary version of Dan-Summerville equations again to obtain a bound on the number of vertices in terms of the boundary. And so it's probably best to look at this lemma, because that lemma sort of captures what you get from the richness. Sort of isoperimetric inequality in one direction. What you get is the following: if you have a rich partition of R4. So again, remember what's a rich partition. There are five tetrahedra. I'm now confused. There are five four-dimensional tetrahedra around every triangle of faith. The boundary of every subset, this is a vertex boundary, is bounded from, so the size of every subset is bounded from above by the constant times the boundary of that subset. You see that as a parametric inequality type result. So there is a global constant C which depends on epsilon in the bound pi over 2 minus epsilon. So that we always get that for every subset of points in the graph. Now this result is not even immediately obvious when x is just one point. This is saying that there is a global constant bound on the number of four-dimensional simplices around that point. You can sort of see it. This is saying that the simplices cannot be long and tall, because that would contradict bounded geometry condition. So this is, so in the very special case, you get this result for one point. But we prove it in general. So that's an inequality in one direction. And now this is going to contradict, more standard inequality, as a parametric inequality, the ones that, as I told you, I haven't seen before. And we needed to redo that because we couldn't find it in the right way that we wanted. So what you do is you make a definition. You define p probability of graphs, and by graphs think of a skeleton of a triangulation R4. Think of one skeleton. So I don't have time. So let me sort of quickly say that p probability if some property of length of certain paths goes to infinity, if supremum of this length goes to infinity, so there is a statement of what does it mean for a graph to be p-parabolic, and there is a result that we needed to reprove somehow because we couldn't find it in the right version, is that the graph of triangulation Rd with bounded geometry is always d-parabolic. So this probability condition sort of reflects the dimension of the space, and then we were lucky to find an existing as a parametric type inequality which was proved just earlier this year by Benyamini and Karian, which basically says if you have a d-parabolic graph, then something about that the parametric inequality function is going to be true, and this is something that whatever it is, let me be very quick. Whatever it is, it's going to contradict our lemma 3. So this is how we prove the result. So I know I did it very quickly at the end, but thank you. Of what? That's a good question. Basically, we asked that at the end of the paper, but I don't think anyone ever tried anything other than Euclidean space to prove anything at all because it's sort of, motivation was Euclidean motivation, the first element method. So I think anything, even I think two-dimensional results in two-dimensional polygons on a sphere, that's already would be new, even though that sounds kind of easy. Yes, I think so. But we just never looked at it, either. We think somebody should, but we haven't. I'm going to tell you the answer, but you're not going to like it. The largest angle is that one. No. This is the first time you get non-9. But there is a reason for that. Basically, we push things around until things start to give you acute angles. So, I mean, this was sort of the answer we got. So our competitors kept improving triangulation, including our triangulation. So they dropped it down to, once they verified our triangulation, and even when you apply their technique to our triangulation, you get something like 84, so which is much more reasonable, but I'm not responsible for that. I have really no idea what exactly the magic they're doing in their mesh improving technique. It's going to have the same combinatorics, so just the points are moved around a little bit to improve the angle.
And the number of displacements in the
vector? So in our case it's about 2700, in their case it's about 1400. I don't believe you can go below like 1000. The problem was open for so long is because it's undoable by recreational methods. You cannot sit on your couch and just come up with the triangulation of a cube. You have to actually use a powerful enough computer to do that, which probably fits the conference theme very well. Thank you.